Hello, welcome back to Christian Leaders Institute. This is the course of World History 101, the beginning, and we are in the period from 1000 to 1500 AD, and we're getting very near the end of the course. Just going to look at one more basic topic for our consideration, and that's the topic of political and social life between 1000 and 1500. And we've looked at a lot of different cultures in the course of this course, but I, for the sake of time, had to just select a few. So we're going to look first at China, and then we'll look at Western Europe, and conclude with that. Probably one more session after this one. So, political and social life in China between 1000 and 1500. Really, we're talking about three different dynasties, three different imperial rules, the Song, the Yong, and the Ming. And we'll begin with the Song dynasty that was both a northern and then later they added the southern part of China. And really, virtually all of what we think about as modern-day China is incorporated into that. They go basically from the beginning of our time in the 10th century all the way to the almost the end of the 13th century. So the first third or so of our time period is under the Song Dynasty. And I just selected one period during that time. The Song Dynasty, of course, as with most of the imperial times in China, there's very strong leadership in the top. There's an emperor, a vast bureaucracy that is very well trained. China is way ahead of the rest of the world in terms of technological interventions. They have movable type centuries before Gutenberg got it in Europe. They are using gunpowder for both celebrations, but also for military. They are way ahead in terms of production of silk and wool and other luxury products. And they have a vast irrigation system. They are master builders. And, of course, they are almost constantly at war, either keeping the peace within the borders of China or else fighting foreigners. One of the emperors is Sheng Song, and he reigned from, he was emperor from 1067 to 1085, a relatively short period of time, less than 20 years. But he was quite innovative in terms of his social and political understanding of how the imperial power, the state power, was there to benefit the people. And we see this yin and yang, if you will, throughout Chinese history, that there are periods in which the imperial power took advantage of the people. They were quite ruthless. They were avaricious in how they abused the people, incredible taxation, incredible military levies, and the like. But there are other times in which the imperial powers ruled really on behalf of and in benefit of the people. And that's the case here in Shensong's rule. There is no reading assignment on the outside. The reading assignment I'm going to basically incorporate into the comments this morning. So here is a relatively lengthy quotation from Encyclopedia Britannica on this period of time. Shen Song responded vigorously and rather unexpectedly from the standpoint of many bureaucrats, and that is, it's a real switch in how the previous empire had ruled the people. Sheng Song moved it, like, as I mentioned, toward really taking care of the people, seeing the government as really benefiting the people, to the problems troubling the established order, some of which were approaching crisis proportions. Keeping above partisan politics, he made the scholar-poet Wang Anxi his chief counselor and gave him full backing to make sweeping reforms. Known as the New Laws, or New Policies, These reform measures attempted drastic institutional changes. And this next paragraph describes those changes. And you'll notice how advanced a society is. They're using currency, both coin and paper. They are very ahead of time in terms of how they deal with agriculture and the like, and the tax policy. The government squarely faced the reality of a rapidly spreading money economy. No longer was it just trading goods for goods. Now there is money coming in. And a lot of it has to do with their trade over the Silk Routes and the sea routes, trade with Europe. By spreading money economy, by increasing the supply of currency, the state became involved in trading, buying specific products in one area for resale elsewhere, and thereby facilitating the exchange of goods. So in this global trade, worldwide trade, they intervened, stabilizing prices wherever and whenever and wherever necessary, and making a profit itself. This did not displace private trading activities. On the contrary, the government extended loans to small urban and regional traders through state pawn shops. Pawn shops, I think. A practice somewhat like modern government banking, but unheard of at the time. And so the state began to loan smaller businesses money in order for them to keep going. And that's a new practice. Far more important, if not controversial, the government made loans at the interest rate low for the period of 20% to the whole peasantry during the sowing season, thus assuring their farming productivity and undercutting their dependency upon usurious loans from the well-to-do. So the state got involved in helping bankroll farmers so that they could plant their seed and like farm their land at only a 20% rate of interest, which to us might sound horrible, but for them was actually a good rate. The government also maintained granaries in various cities to ensure adequate supplies on hand in case of emergency need. The burden on wealthy and poor alike was made more equitable by a graduated tax scale based on a reassessment of the size and productivity of the landholdings. So a graduated tax system in which it is a percentage system rather than just a flat tax for everybody, is seen as benefiting particularly those on the lower end. Similarly, compulsory labor was converted to a system of graduated tax payments. So no longer did you trade your hours of labor, now you could pay a tax. Which were used to finance a hired labor service program that, at least theoretically, controlled unemployment in farming areas. Again, the state intervened. They collected taxes rather than hourly people coming in, forcing labor, and then used those taxes in order to pay laborers. So that during this period of time and during these Wang reforms or new laws, the state really helped particularly the lower class of people to rise out of abject poverty. Requisition of various supplies from guilds also replaced by cash assessments with which the government was to buy what was needed at a fair price. The magnitude of the reform program was matched only by the bitter opposition to it. So it's not as if this reform program was dearly loved by everyone. And you can imagine the same folks in their culture, in their day, in the 11th century, are the same folks who have difficulty with such programs today. Determined criticism came from groups hurt by the reform measures, large landowners, big merchants, and moneylenders. Without directly attacking the emperor, the critics attacked the reformers for deviating from orthodox Confucianism. So they used the argument that Confucianism, which had established a very set order, you remember, the really heart of the Confucian understanding is that the father figure is the absolute ruler of the household and everyone must do exactly what he says, and they really all serve the father. They changed it to a much more equitable system, people said, that's not how our government works. That's not pure Confucianism. And the Wang reforms are opposed. And after this emperor passes from the scene, they pretty well also pass from the scene in imperial China. The Song Dynasty is followed by the Wang Dynasty, and these are really the heirs of Genghis Khan. It is the Mongols and the Wang Dynasty are fundamentally the same. The Mongols, over a series of years, take control militarily of everything that we think of China and also down into Southeast Asia, into parts particularly of Vietnam and the like. They did so by military conquest, and then once they had established themselves as the rulers, the Mongols or Wans, tried to govern more or less as Chinese. They did not, and this is true wherever the Mongols went, they usually did not obliterate and replace the kind of social and political life that was there before. The areas that they had conquered, they adapted to it, and for the most part, let the local leaders run things. The 1260s, the central bureaucracy and local administration of the Chinese Empire were remodeled on Chinese lines, with certain alterations introduced by the Jin state. And that was a previous empire up in the north. That, again, is a quote from Britannica. But in other ways, the Wan and Mongols were clearly a foreign system. I thought this was an important paragraph. The unwillingness of the Mongols to assimilate with Chinese. And so while they did adapt sort of Chinese ways, they kept themselves aloof, the Mongols did. They did not mix socially with the other Chinese. So the unwillingness of the Mongols to assimilate with the Chinese is shown by their attempts to cement the inequalities of their rule. After the Song Empire had been conquered, the population of China was divided into four classes, really five. The first class was the Mongols themselves, a tiny but privileged minority. And in that way, as I mentioned earlier, they carried on the tradition that everybody really existed to serve them and to provide for their needs and their luxury. Next came the Semarin, people with special status. And these are people who are confederates of the Mongols, such as the Turks or the Middle Eastern Muslims. Remember, the Mongols loved trade and fostered trade. I think I made reference that in the Mongol notion, a woman alone with just a purse should be able to travel from one end of their empire to another and not be bothered or in any way, be able to do that safely. And that's just a saying that illustrates that they really wanted free trade throughout their empire. And for the most part, it is Turks and Arabs who are the middlemen in this trade system. And here they are the sort of the second layer in Wan China. Third group was called the Haren, Han. A term generally means Chinese. Han and Chinese are virtually synonymous. But that was used to designate the inhabitants of only northern China. This class includes the Chinese and other ethnic groups living in the former Jin state, as well as the Chai Chia, the Yukon, the Khitan, the Koreans. And during this period of time, Korea is considered a province of China. The Bohai and the Tangut, who could be employed in some functions and who also formed military units under Mongol leadership. So this third group is a large class, numerous class, of ethnic Chinese who are trusted to a great degree. Many of them are from the north, and they are given ability to have jobs in the government as well as military leadership. The last group was the Naren, or Mansi, with this pejorative term in Chinese, and that means the southern barbarians. So the Mongols, the Wan Dynasty, definitely favored the people who lived in the northern areas of China. That designated the former subjects of Song China, about three-fourths of the Chinese Empire. And then, as I said, there really is five. The lowest stratum in Yuan China was occupied by slaves whose numbers were quite considerable, and slave status was hereditary, and only under certain conditions could a slave be free. So during the Yuan time, which is basically the 13th century and early 14th century, during the Yuan dynasty, China is divided very much into social classes, quite rigid. The Mongols are on top. There are other classes underneath. And everyone was understood to serve the Mongol overlords. More than four-fifths of the taxpayers came from the Naren group, which was generally barred from holding higher office. Only rarely would one of them rise to some sort of prominence. The Mongols and the Semarin, that's the second group, were the tax-exempt and enjoyed the protection of the law to a higher degree than did the Haren and Naren. And again, that is a quote from a Britannica article under Kublai Khan and his successors. As mentioned, Mongol rulers favored trade in all their dominions. In China, too, they eliminated state trade controls that had existed under the Song and the Jin, so that internal and external trade reached unprecedented proportions. So the commerce between the East and West, between Britain and China, and all parts lying in between, really flourished during this period of time, during the late 13th and early 14th centuries of our time. It seems, however, that China's intercontinental trade with the Middle East and Europe was in the hands of the non-Chinese, that is, mainly the Persians, the Arabs, and the Syrians. So the local Chinese people did not profit all that much. It was really the middlemen who profited the most. Silk, the Chinese export commodity par excellence, reached the Middle East and even Europe via the caravan routes across Asia. Chinese ceramics were also exported, chiefly into the Islamic countries. The Asian countries concentrated their European trade largely with the Italian republics. I mentioned before that Genoa and Venice at this time are extraordinarily wealthy places and powerful places in Europe, certainly the most powerful cities in Europe because of that trade between China and Europe. To the Italians, trade with the East was so important that the Pratica della Miracata, a handbook, Miracatura, a handbook on foreign trade, including the description of trade routes to China. This is during the Yuan decline, or during the Yuan dynasty. They, of course, do decline. They fractured into numerous states. And the Yuan are, historically in Chinese history, really not considered Chinese. They're remembered as being the Mongols who ruled China for a while. This happens to be, by the way, the era of Marco Polo, a famous name, particularly in the West. He was a trader from Venice, I believe, or at least Italy, who took a journey and traveled, according to his record, traveled all through China, became an official in the Yuan state, met Kublai Khan, and traveled, was gone for 20 years or something like that, gone for a long time, and came back to Europe and published his travels, the travels of Marco Polo, which became, in its own way, a bestseller in Europe. And this really fired the imagination of the Europeans in particular, of what could be accomplished and how one could gain and learn, particularly from the East. This is a rendering of Marco Polo. You can see he's dressed in really sort of Chinese, but mostly Mongolian looks. He has a Mongolian bow with him. And as I said, he became an official in the court of Kublai Khan, who was, I believe, a grandson of Genghis Khan and is likely the most famous Yuan emperor. By 1368, and really lasting 300 years almost until 1644, the Ming Dynasty took over. They ousted the Yuan, they take over, and they are quintessentially Chinese. When we think of Chinese culture, it is very much the Ming Dynasty. Here's another quote from Britannica. The Ming Dynasty, which encompassed the reigns of 16 emperors, proved to be one of the stablest and longest ruling periods in Chinese history. Rulers of Korea, Mongolia, East Turkestan, Myanmar, Siam, and Vietnam Vet regularly acknowledged Ming overlordship. So in other words, really all of, almost all of what we call Asia today, Southeast Asia, mainland China, Korea, Japan, came under Ming, Ming rulers. And at times, tribute was received from as far away as Japan, Java, Sumatra, Sri Lanka, and South India, the Eastern African coast, the Persian Gulf region, and Samarkand. Samarkand is one of those famous cities on the caravan routes, on the Silk Routes, which is a fabulously important place, very wealthy city, but which has since pretty much been overcome by the desert. Modern Chinese honor the Ming emperors, especially for having restored China's international power and prestige, which had been in decline since the 8th century. The Ming emperors probably exercised more far-reaching influence in East Asia than any other native rulers of China, and their attitude toward the representatives of Portugal, Spain, Russia, Britain, and Holland who appeared in China before the end of their dynasty was a condescending one. The Ming dynasty thought of themselves really as the greatest culturally, militarily, the most advanced people in the world, and everyone else was basically a barbarian. This is a map of the Ming dynasty, what they controlled, the Ming Empire, and you can see that it is very much all of modern China and much of Southeast Asia as well. Huge dynasty, the Ming. The Ming did reinstate the notion, or continued the notion, that the people serve the emperor, and they are not particularly well known for helping out the peasant class or the lower class, but they are well known for bringing out a very, very high degree of culture and of art. This is just one image of a Ming vase. One hears about such things. Tremendously important and tremendously valuable. Their work in ceramics and in China, plateware and other porcelain products, other ceramic products that make their way to the East and to the West, is still legendary today. So that's the Ming Dynasty. So what we see in the social and political life of China during this period of time is basically those three different dynasties, and they had take different attitudes toward the life of the regular people. In some regards, there's a period of time in which the rulers and the government exist in order to help the people, and but for most of the time, it's the other way around, that people exist, the commoners exist in order to make the emperors more wealthy. And the wealth of those emperors is legendary. We're going to move now to Western Europe. And There's so many themes that one can pick up during this period of time from 1000 to 1500. The theme that I'm going to stress, or at least kind of hold it all together, is that this is a period of time in which Western Europe moves from the minor principalities ruled by local leaders, barons, princes, and the like of the local areas. Often that's a continuation of the old tribal relationships, more toward the nation state. So that by the end of our period, by the 16th century, the whole notion of nationhood, that you belong to an entity that's much greater than just where you can travel in a day or two, is pretty firmly established, particularly in France and England, the two nations, and Spain, the nations that become the major players in the 17th and 18th centuries. We'll get to that in the next course, but we're laying the foundation now. So it's that move during this period of time toward that understanding of becoming a national identity. This is just a series of maps to illustrate a little bit what that might look like. So this is in the 814. So this is in the 9th century. What we basically see are a couple of different kingdoms. Charles the Great here. This area is controlled by Muslims. Here is still Byzantium. And just basically tribal areas with tribal kings in the 9th and early 10th century. If we move along a few hundred years, so now we've moved almost to 1200. So let's say the beginning of the 13th century, we begin to see that there are national identities that begin to start to build. Hungary in particular is important. Germany is under the control of the Holy Roman Empire, which basically means it's under control of the Pope. Kingdom of Sicily divides the Italian boot between the what's governed by the Pope and what's governed by the Kingdom of Sicily. Spain is still divided into a number of different countries. France is just a small area with Normandy and Anjou and Aquitaine, all as independent local political entities. England is very much divided into Ireland and Wales and Scotland, and they are constantly fighting each other during this period of time. We move ahead another 100 years or so, and now we begin to get a sense of some larger national powers growing. We have the Empire of Germany. France has taken over most of those other little countries. England still is divided into various principalities, Scotland, Ireland, but Wales now is firmly a part of an English identity. Poland begins to have an identity, Hungary does, Russia does, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and the like. Until we move into this area, this I believe is the, this is the 14th century. There's some disintegration again during this period of time. They break apart and sort of revert back to their old identities. Here we are, the Holy Roman Empire, and the 1470s. So now we're getting almost to our 1500, and in the 15th century here, we see some very clear identities coming out of England, which is now fully in control of Ireland. Soon they'll be joined with Scotland through in the Tudors. You have France, which pretty well is in control. The Holy Roman Empire still controls much with the including the Netherlands. Castile and Aragon are soon to unite and create the nation of Spain. Portugal will retain a clear identity that's separate but very powerful identity. And Hungary, Poland. So what I would really like you to observe and come along with me is the story of how these Europe becomes gains a national identity for the various countries, particularly for France and for England, the two nations, and Spain. Those three nations in the next few centuries are going to dominate, the world in many ways. So let's turn now to Western Europe between 1000 and 1500, the political and social life. The Middle Ages are often described in Europe as a time of feudalism. That term is not in very helpfully used anymore. Modern historians have all sorts of difficulty with that term, and mostly the critique is that it implies that there's really only one system that's going on in Europe, and that is not the case. Europe is a mishmash of local customs and systems of how arrangements are made between particularly those who are in charge, those who are ruling, and those who are ruled. So we won't talk much about feudalism in that way, but it is the case that, particularly in Christian lands, that the notion of being bound to someone else by an oath, what's called fealty and homage, where someone voluntarily, mostly, will pledge their service and will pledge their life to another, be that a local leader or the local leaders to the king, and there are gradations and steps to that. But that is a very common practice. So I think of medieval Europe as really a time of being of oaths, taking a vow to serve the next person up the ladder as central to how medieval Europe worked. So they make these oath-bound obligations. That really starts around the year 800 with Charlemagne and the like. But by the end of our period, 1500, that pretty well has declined, that oath-bound relationship. There's still a little bit of it in some countries. France keeps it a little bit longer than other places. But for the most part, that sort of relationship between those who are ruled and the rulers is not the fundamental way that life is organized. Instead, it is really the rise of national identities where the particularly the king and the parliament, the ruling body in England, people give their allegiance to that identity where the king becomes really the embodiment of the nation. But it isn't an oath-bound thing. It is a thing of pride, and it is a matter of, as I said, identity. We are all Englishmen, for instance, together. Middle Ages are a time in which the power of the church is unparalleled. The Christian church is unparalleled. It is equally as powerful, if not more so, in every one of these countries in Western Europe. It is, in a lot of ways, the medieval church is the super organization that binds all of Western Europe together. There's when the Pope speaks, he speaks to the French, and he speaks to the English, and he speaks to the Danish, and he speaks to the Italians and the Spanish. When the Pope speaks, everyone presumably listens. And during this period of time, the church claims to have exclusive power over granting salvation. And I think I've illustrated before, how this is a time period in Western Europe in which a sense of how tenuous, how scary life is because of many factors. Living and dying was a matter of each moment, whether that was for yourself or for your children. And so people's spiritual life very much focused on the afterlife. And it was through their exclusive claim to have power in the sacraments that the church either granted salvation to people or withheld it. And the same was true with prayers. They had control over the prayers. A priest or someone from an organization that you would pay, they said prayers for you. Your own prayers were not very significant. That's an innovation of Martin Luther. It's also the beginning of the middle class, what sometimes is called the bourgeois, but But these are really the merchants, the merchant class, as well as the trades people, people who didn't farm the land, but often made equipment by which the lands were farmed, or people who built the cities, built the great cathedrals. This is the time of building the great cathedrals and castles. And so there's lots of employment for masons and lots of employment for stonecutters and for people who make wheels. Those are called the coopers. This is a time in which those occupations began to build their own guilds and also to be able to begin to negotiate for wages with the powers that be. So it wasn't just a case that I pledged my time to my overlord and he would throw me some food now and then. It was a case that I had a trade to sell. I had a skill to sell. And would you be willing to pay for that? And the guilds were very important in that. It is a period of time in which there's not a surplus, but there is a lively trade in day-to-day goods that the merchant people began to become important. Particularly, England trades wool to the continent in the Netherlands and in France. They produce woolen products, and wool, in many respects, is the commodity par excellence that runs medieval Europe. So as I mentioned, this is both a time in which those oath-bound relationships govern all of life, but they also, by the end of the period of time, we see that these relationships have declined. The primary thing that one did when you pledged loyalty, took an oath, is that you said that you would supply military power, military might, either in terms of weapons or arms or funds or soldiers, to the next person up the line. And the person to whom you pledged would say, okay, then I will protect you, particularly from foreign invaders, as well as govern the land with laws. So it was in return for control of the land and the population. As I said, this is primarily a Western European function and seems to be the main way society is organized from about 800 to 1400. So why did it decline? What are some of the factors? Well, I'm going to mention just four. And previously in the course, we talked about how great changes often happen on a number of different levels at the same time. There's almost always an environmental change. Historians are very interested in that. Technological change that happens in that. There's a change in perception of identity and also in economic change. And so I've selected these four topics in order to illustrate those kinds of changes. They all contributed in their own way to the decline of this oath-bound system. Here's a reading assignment for you. It is on Wikipedia, the Wikipedia article on the Black Death. So, the Black Death in the 14th century, first half of the 14th century, pan-edemic. That means it is a disease, killing disease, that is widespread all over the world. And that is certainly true. Likely carried by fleas on rats, although there are still some debates. A lot of people think that people's immune systems are already weakened by bad water or inadequate nutrition or overwork or climate, whatever the like. But it is the case that the bacteria that causes bubonic plague enters Europe. It likely spreads from Central Asia and goes in all directions. It goes to the east, to Asia, and enters India a little bit later, but still India is greatly affected. China, millions die in China of Black Death, particularly in the southern regions. Vietnam in particular is remembered as having lost great parts of its population. In the Middle East, there's one report of in Baghdad, for instance, that there was no one left alive in Baghdad to bury the dead once the Black Death hit there. And, of course, in Europe. So it isn't just a European phenomenon. It is an entire phenomenon. Everywhere were the Silk Routes. Everywhere there was commerce and trade from Central Asia, that's where Black Death traveled. And it certainly did travel along with the trade routes. In Europe, within a decade, worldwide, about 30% of the world's population dies. Those kinds of figures are hard to get a hold on, but if you just look around where you are, or if you're in a store and you just start counting, and it's just every third person, one, two, three, they're gone. One, two, three, they're gone. One, two, three, they're gone. And that is death. It doesn't count those whose lives have been, because of the disease, they've been very much crippled or handicapped by the disease. If it doesn't kill you, it certainly leaves you very weak and vulnerable. You might catch other diseases. You certainly won't be able to work. One of the huge things that come as a result of the Black Plague is that there just aren't enough people around to carry on society. There aren't enough people left, not only just to bury the dead, but also to tend to the living. There aren't enough people to farm the lands. Agriculture changes. There becomes a great food shortage after the Black Death because there just aren't enough people to raise the crops. Estimates range widely. Some think that maybe 50% of the population of Western Europe dies. So that's every other person. It is an unbelievable kind of a plague that hits. Well, in its aftermath, and basically it's in the 1320s or 30s that this happens in Europe, there becomes an intense persecution of those who are suspected to somehow be spreading it. Jews were thought to have been poisoning the water, for instance, because oddly enough, Jewish populations didn't die at the same rates as Gentile populations, and people thought, well, the Jews are causing this. The reason they didn't die is that Jewish family homes often were cleaner. They didn't have as many rats, they weren't infected as much, and so they didn't get the bubonic plague nearly at the same rate. But people blamed the Jews, and there was widespread Jewish persecution in Europe. Lepers and others who had clear diseases were thought to be causing this somehow. Other minority groups are thought to be the cause of this, and people believe that they, their existence, their being in society was bringing on God's wrath. And so what we had to do in order to get God on our side, always the question of religion, religious practice, is to exterminate these people. If we just get rid of them, then God will come back and save us from this horrible plague. Many of the Jews at this time escape and they go east, where the plague isn't so bad. They go east into Poland and Russia, and that's one reason why there was a very large population in eastern Russia of Jewish people. I mentioned that very much during this period of time there's a real fixation on death and the afterlife with its religious practices that come involved. Repentance becomes a very important part of public religious practices. There are people who go through the streets with whips, whipping themselves to show that they are repentant, hoping again somehow to get God to relieve them of this horrible plague. There is an abandoning of faith to some degree. Some go far one way in their religious practice, and some go far the other, saying, well, let us eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow we might die. And so they simply abandoned their faith, abandoned all Christian morality and all common ethics in this period of time. There's a tremendous shortage of clergy. The clergy, and there are all different levels of clergy, you know, the Pope and the cardinals and the archbishops and the bishops, the abbots of the monasteries, the monks, the nuns, the friars, the priests. As I said, the church is about half of the society. Many of them take it upon themselves to be the primary caregivers of people who have the plague. And so they, of course, catch it themselves. And so many, many priests and monks and nuns and abbots, friars die in this time. And this leads to the closing of many monasteries. Now, the monasteries are not only where the monks and the nunneries are, where the nuns live, but they are also significant landholders. For instance, in England, in the Middle Ages, half the nation, half the countryside is actually owned by the church. And they tax the people, they raise armies, they function basically as an alternative government in England. And but so many of the clergy die at this time, and the monks and the nuns, that the monasteries have to be abandoned. There's no one left to live there. Sometimes the land goes fallow, they're just abandoned, but other times people begin to swallow that up. And this is a movement toward the lessening of the church's authority and power and wealth because of the Black Death. As I mentioned, there's a loss of the workforce, and also the relationship between the Lord and labor now becomes more of that contract base. The laborers have a skill, there are very few of them, and so they have some clout to begin to bargain with the Lord. The large landed estates, or the various baronies and estates begin to shrink very much in size. There aren't enough farmers, there aren't enough workers to take care of them. Wages, while still fixed by the government, begin to increase some. And there's actually a movement away from the countryside and into the towns and the cities. And the countryside returns to a much more wild, less cultivated area. This is the time that the forest grows. This is a time very much when the land, instead of being used, instead of being plowed up and sown with seed, now goes to pasture because they're able to have a flock of sheep. Takes much less labor than trying to till acres of farmland. This is a fun kind of map that shows the spread of the Black Death during this period of time and during really these years. So we're only really talking about 5 or 6 years here in how fast the Black Death spreads. And you see, by the end of the period of time, by 1350 more or less, it is from one ocean to the next. A third of the population of that area dies at this time. So that is an environmental change. And the way that works for coming more to a national identity is, number one, the power of the church becomes loosened. And number two, there just are many fewer of these small principalities. They can't go on. There just aren't enough people to live there. And also the rise of the middle class. In terms of technological changes, one of the main reasons that there's a movement away from the oath-bound society in which I pledge to you my loyalty and I'll supply you with two knights with shining armor, and they'll fight for you, they'll be mercenaries for you. The knights really are the elite warriors in Europe during this period of time, but they take a tremendous amount of money to fund, and armor and the like to keep up. And battles were often fundamentally between these knights. They might be small. They might only be might have two baronies fighting, but there might only be 20 knights fighting each other. You know, it's relatively small, small scale. Well, in this period of time, and from the Welsh, the English learn about this thing called the longbow. It's about this tall, made out of stout English oak, and it fires arrows at about a third farther than did the old crossbow that was in use, and it fired with such potency that it could pierce the armor that was on the horses, as well as, for the most part, that knights wore. And this began to really change things. So in the 14th century, the English began to use the longbow in their battles with the French. We haven't paused to talk about what is called the Hundred Years' War. Basically, it's about a 100-year period during which England and France were almost in constant battle with each other, or portions thereof. And near the end of it, the English bring over this new invention, the longbow. So the Battle of Agincourt is often sort of the highlighted. It's one of the more famous battles between the French and the English. The English win, and the reason they win is because they use the longbows and pretty well decimate the French armies. It really spells the end of the age of the knights. And the knights are totally wrapped up in this Middle Ages idea of oath-bound allegiance. They are the gladiators that I will supply to you in order to protect you. I'm bound to you. Here's my knight. He will take care of your military needs. He'll be your mercenary. Well, once the power of the knights begins to fade, then very much it becomes larger scale troops, larger armies, men equipped with different kinds of weapons. So that by the end of our period, the English longbow has made the knights virtually obsolete. And the English continue to use this throughout our period of time. However, the longbow is also soon to be replaced, and beginning to be replaced by 1500 with artillery fired by that invention they got from China called gunpowder. So by the time the 16th century begins, gunpowder becomes much more significant even than the longbow. And again, now you have larger armies, larger groups going against each other. They begin to become a professionally trained army, and that contributes greatly to the notion of growth of nations. So now it is an army in service to France, in service to Spain, in service to England, rather than just a couple of people that I'm supplying to the person up the line. Here's an image of an Englishman with a longbow, fired to great effect, and they would rain down hundreds and thousands of arrows on the knights. Third thing, and this is an economic development, we're going to just call it the rise of the middle class. In that old oath-bound relationship, there's basically just a few at the top and they're bound to each other, and I grant you all these other people to work for you. We used to call them serfs, but we'll just call them peasants. All the people to work your lands, tend your animals, take care of your household, run your castle. All those people are really, they're my possessions. They belong to me, and I give you freedom to use them however you want. Well, a lot of those people began to have these specialized skills that they can barter for, and I talked about the guilds coming up. And then others become the merchants who deal, as I said, wool is one of the significant commodities that's traded. It's much more a contractual-based society. And with contracts, of course, comes law. And with law comes courts and people to adjudicate on that. Come written documents. So now you have to have scribes and you have to have attorneys and barristers and the like. Much more a contractual society and less that oath-bound one of the Middle Ages. This leads to a real loosening of control of the barons and the landowner class that goes all the way up to the king. So it's not that personal relationship so much once the middle class becomes in. In some places, the guilds replace the church as the communal locus of prayer and faith. The guilds are actually places where you can have other people there pray for you and care for you. They become your community of faith. The guild is where my identity lies in many significant ways. And lastly, there becomes a centralization of royal power. So the identity of allegiance, to whom I is less now just focused on that baron who lives in that castle or that prince who lives there. Now it's very much in the king or the queen who embody the nation and the national level. The royal family becomes extremely important and who they are and they're loved and admired or hated as the case may be. And as I mentioned, along with these changes, there are huge changes in royal administrations, particularly in England, where practices of law develop, where practices of adjudication, contracts, and all of those various things come during this period of time. And that leads more to a national identity where there is a unified system that will protect people no matter where they live. And under whose reign they are. So there's a growing awareness of belonging to more than just a local lord. Rather, you belong to the local power. And as I mentioned, this also is a time of the church's decline in secular power and especially of wealth. We talked previously about the Western Schism when there were the Pope moved from Rome to Avignon, and where the French king really becomes the ruler, has control over the Pope. And then there are those anti-popes. There's really two popes going on at the same time, and nobody knows, and it's confusing. All of that contributed to people's lessening of trust and allegiance to the church as the unifying power within Europe. And now that vacuum is replaced by a beginning sense of a unifying power as a nation, as a people. I am part of a greater whole than just what goes on locally. For convenience sake, historians and others talk about, you know, the nation of France, and then we might talk about that in the 3rd century, 4th century, 5th century, but that really is not the case. There is no sense of nation until really the 15th, 16th, 17th century. That's a much more recent development, this notion of the nation state. Prior to that, it did not function. People lived basically just on their local level and didn't have a broader national understanding. Okay, the church is, as I mentioned, equal in power during the medieval time from 1000 to 1500, equal or greater in power than any other institution in Western Europe. It is the major landowner. The major landowner in Europe. It is extraordinarily wealthy, and that wealth is really controlled by the clergy. The clergy are allowed to tax the people who live in their domains, and particularly the bishops and the archbishops and the abbots. There's no vow of poverty in these parts. These people become fabulously wealthy. Just to illustrate, Cardinal Wolsey, at the end of our period of time, is the head of the church in England, the Catholic Church. This is during Henry VIII's time, but before Henry VIII splits with the Pope. And Cardinal Wolsey is the wealthiest person in that period of time. More wealthy than the king, is the wealthiest person in England, because of all the estates and lands that he holds. They also, of course, bishops and priests and monks and nuns and friars, they also do spread the faith, and they do take care of people. They man the churches and the like. And true to the church's calling and mission throughout our history, education is a very central part of what they do, as well as care for the sick. The whole notion of hospitals, and for the most part, the universities and the various academies for training are all under the jurisdictions of the church. It is really through the use of sacraments and the understanding of sacraments as the means by which salvation is granted, by the means of grace, that the church controls the daily life of people. It controls their salvation, their hope, their notion of eternal life. Without the church, there is no afterlife. There's no more. And, as I mentioned, this is the fundamental yearning of people in the Middle Ages. So the church is an extraordinarily powerful thing. The person there are many important leaders in the church during this period of time, but I just selected to say something about Thomas Aquinas, because he is such a central figure to the medieval, and in many ways illustrates the social life in the Middle Ages. But I think that what we'll do is come to Thomas next time in our final lecture in this course, and save that discussion until then when we talk about Thomas Aquinas and the Renaissance. Thank you for your time. Do your reading assignments, and may God bless you in this day. Thank you.